healthcare marketing. Influence, sales, commission, profits, nurses. Wait, nurses? Come on. I'm Christiana Facey Crowther, and I'll be your nurse. Marketing in healthcare. We know it exists. There's been lots of reporting and stories in the past decade that look at conflict of interest, industry influence through lobbying, the funding of research, sponsorship of events, and even direct payments to healthcare providers. And we know that it works to increase sales and profits. Also, we see the reps. They're around and actually pretty conspicuous with their little wheelie suitcases and just generally looking less disheveled than the rest of us. Just this past month in December, the BMJ published an analysis that describes the influence that industry has over the generation and use of healthcare evidence and how this can lead to both harm and waste. But I think that as a nurse, this can all feel largely external. I certainly thought of it as influence that happened outside of my own scope. That is, until I spoke with Quinn Grundy and read the book she wrote based on work she did in her PhD. What she found certainly surprised me, and you might find it surprises you too. Quinn Grundy, thank you for joining me at the bedside.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So you recently published a book.
Yes.
Infiltrating Healthcare, How Marketing Works Underground to Influence Nurses. And I'm thrilled to talk to you about that. It's a great book. I enjoyed it. It's super interesting. Can we just start by you describing your career in nursing and what drew you to this research topic?
Sure. So this began for me as a doctoral student. And I had the privilege of working with Professor Ruth Malone, who is a world-renowned nurse researcher who studies the activities of the tobacco industry, and specifically how marketing and lobbying and public relations have created a tobacco-related disease epidemic. And she introduced to me the idea that we could actually look at practices like marketing, like lobbying, like PR, like funding of scientific research as things to study in their own right and to understand how they impact lifestyle choices, but also population health, public policy, and the evidence we base decisions on. And at that time, the United States government was bringing in the Affordable Care Act. And there was one little piece of that called the United States Physician Payments Sunshine Act, which required all pharmaceutical and medical device companies to publicly report in a database that anyone can search any payment made to a physician that was valued at $10 or more. And I was surprised that nurses were not included in this. I knew that nurses sometimes spoke on behalf of pharmaceutical companies. I'd gone with my preceptor as a student nurse to a drug company-sponsored dinner. I saw them at our conferences giving away gifts or hosting breakfasts. And I wondered if policymakers didn't know this was happening or if they somehow thought it wasn't that important.
And so, and then you started to do a doctorate on this? Is that what happened? You did your PhD?
So this book actually was born as in my dissertation. And as a doctoral student, I went to four different hospitals in a city in the western U.S. Looking to see how nurses actually interacted with pharmaceutical, medical device, or other types of companies in their day-to-day practice.
So let's just get a sense, if you can, Quinn, when you're talking about these industries and their marketing, what kind of marketplace, what kind of economy are we really talking about?
So I approach the question pretty open-ended in the sense that I wasn't even sure which industries were interacting with nurses. So we know that pharmaceutical and medical device companies spend $70 billion a year on marketing. And largely that's to physicians or clinicians in direct interactions. And it's almost twice what they spend on research and development. So it's a very marketing intensive industry. And because they can't always market their products directly to consumers, they have to go through health professionals as middlemen. But with nurses, they interact with a lot of different kinds of people in really diverse care settings, through the hospital, through the community. And so I also wanted to ask nurses what kinds of industry representatives they encountered in their work. And what they came to me was that it was not only pharmaceutical, but medical device played very strongly in their practice, but also health information technology and electronic health record vendors, infant formula and nutrition companies, and a whole host of private or proprietary health services like ambulance companies or for-profit nursing homes.
Wow. So it's, I mean, I think the media attention and when we think about marketing, typically you think about that traditional medication to the provider to prescribe to patients. But it is so much more, right? All of the products that we engage with in our work environment, including the ancillary companies that we work with, all of this is relying on marketing and is part of this economy.
So in my book, I've called this medically related industry, for want of a better term. And I think nurses have interaction with a really broad array of these companies. And even though we have a publicly funded health system and that a lot of our care is reimbursed through the government, there are these ancillary players that are marketing their products. And I think we see pharmaceutical or medical device companies, we've done the most research on them. Those strategies are perhaps most visible. And particularly for products that require a prescription, we know that they've targeted doctors. But for lots of other things, nurses are the decision makers. And these other companies, big or small, adopt many of the same strategies that you'd think of with pharma reps or sponsored dinners or branded pens in their own promotional activities.
Now, you describe how marketing works underground to target nurses. And I think even as a nurse myself, like when I picked up the book and I sort of was looking at it, I thought, I mean, I wonder how a whole book is written about marketing, because I thought about it, how it would apply in my own practice environment. I thought, I don't really think that's relevant to me. Honestly, I did think that. And it seems that what you've uncovered is that pharmaceutical companies are spending quite a lot of, not just pharma, medical-related industries are spending a lot of money marketing to nurses. So it's not like a small amount. It's a significant proportion of their budget is towards nurses, correct?
I think we don't know.
We don't know.
And partly, I've labeled this as underground because so little policy attention. And I think these interactions still fly under the radar. So when I first approached hospitals and I wanted to investigate this, interview nurses, maybe shadow some of them, a lot of the administrators said, oh, our nurses don't interact with industry. And if they do, it would be just, you know, a presentation within a structured committee or at a staff meeting, or only in the context of an appointment or maybe an in-service. So you should go somewhere that doesn't have a policy like we have. And that gave me pause, because I said, okay, well, nurses don't interact with industry except on committees, except in in-services, except if they had an appointment. So what's all that? I'm interested in that, too. And what I found is that when you talk about marketing, people think about going to a fancy steakhouse that, you know, pharma's footing the bill, or the sales rep cold calling the doctor's office. But nurses are interacting with industry, and typically that's a sales representative, someone in a sales role. But the interaction is not called marketing, or it doesn't feel like marketing. And instead, they were labeling these kind of interactions as training or education or support, even though a salesperson was delivering that training or education or support. And I think increasingly, in its work with nurses or in trying to partner with nurses, industry presents itself as a partner, or it's providing resources to help nurses in their practice, or it's providing access to education nurses can't otherwise get. And in some ways, that's more seductive than gifts and meals and other sorts of more blatant sponsorship, because it doesn't feel like marketing.
I think that's really true. When we think about what marketing, if you're an outsider or a healthcare provider and you think about what marketing would look like, you assume that someone's coming in with a number of products and from a first meeting and trying to say, you should use this thing. You don't think about it in terms of the relationships of the people who maybe come and show you, hey, we just developed this. This is going to help you out a lot. You're often actually quite grateful for those innovations and those sort of ways to provide care in a different way in your practice that maybe solve some of your practice problems that you're having. But what I found really interesting as well in your book is you talk about the as-if world. That's what you call it, the as-if world of nursing, and why maybe that, if you could just describe what that is, and then we'll talk a bit about why does that make it a little bit easier for companies to market without as much scrutiny or noticing.
So I was doing this work, obviously, under the supervision of Ruth Malone, who was for decades an emergency room nurse. And when we were kind of sitting with the stories that nurses had, she remembered a day in the ER years ago where a physician wrote an order for a patient that said, breathe room air. And she stopped for a moment and said, is this really necessary? Like, without this order, could the ER nurses somehow not figure out what the patient should breathe? And she called this, she coins this, we talk about this in an article, the as-if world of nursing. And there are so many structures. It's often medical legal structures, things like standing orders or physician orders or the types of things you need to get an order for that create the illusion that nurses don't really make decisions. It operates as if nurses are not decision makers, as if the only person making a decision is the one who writes the order. And so I talked to nurses who, you know, had recently been to the fanciest steakhouse in town, pharma-sponsored dinner, enjoyed the night out, listened to the talk, and at the end of it said to me, you know, I just don't understand why they invite us. If I don't prescribe, why would they bother to pay for my steak dinner? I just don't see how that adds up. And then I talked to her a little bit more, and she said, and I said, well, you know, what do you do in your day-to-day job? What's your role? And she explained, I'm with that patient for 12 hours. This was in a critical care, a cardiac setting. She said, you know, when that doctor comes in, I can provide that context. I know exactly how they've been. I know how they're responding to that drug. I know the symptoms. I know the changes. I know this patient minute to minute. And it's up to me to advocate and to communicate that for safe and quality care. And yet she couldn't make the link why that might be of interest to someone selling the drugs that that patient is taking. And I think nurses in some ways also live and breathe and sometimes come up against and sometimes challenge this as-if world. And because our decision-making is very collective and we operate as a unit or as a team, nurses also lose sight of the influence and decision-making power that they have.
I think that's, yeah. So much of the time we make our decisions and we use our, what you're saying, influence away from the bedside, away from visibility. So in the phone, in the advocacy that captures so much of what we do and describing, hey, you know, doing the analysis and the assessment, these symptoms and these side effects may be a result of this medication. Maybe I can recommend switching it to this. And our physician colleagues then say yes. And we may even go so far as to, you know, take an order from them and enter it and initiate therapy as well, obviously in collaboration. And that's just the medications. When it comes to, for example, wound care products, ostomy products, so many of the other products that we engage with in our day-to-day work that I hadn't really honestly thought about in terms of how we advocate for those to be used on the card or we use one product over another, the influence that we have over the choice and the use of different adhesives just in a regular unit. I mean, you provide some examples of purchasing, nurses in charge of purchasing like really big equipment with huge price tags. Again, through collaboration with industry reps. And how Is that evading the notice of regulators and hospital management teams, do you think?
So I think this is, again, back to this characterization of it happening underground or being a bit invisible. So hospitals, I think, every time they purchase or roll out a new product, have been outsourcing that implementation to industry. So part of how device industry, the companies are competing with one another, is to offer a service package. So, for example, your hospital buys new glucometers. They might choose the company who will offer the best in-service training or coverage. And in the purchasing contract, it states how many nurses they have to train, for example, when rolling that out. But when I talk to administrators, they truly believe that interaction was a one-off. When I talk to nurse educators or managers, however, or even frontline nurses, that in-service, it seemed really benign, pretty straightforward, was often a chance for relationships to form. And the sales rep would leave their card. If nurses had issues with the equipment going forward, that was someone else they could call in the middle of the night, on the weekend. For managers or educators, they couldn't possibly do that training with the resources they had. But they often had issues. They wanted sales reps to stay on script, for example, but couldn't necessarily supervise that. So on the ground, it was much, much more complex than what the view that the administration had, which is probably typical for a lot of nursing issues. And so I think it's really important to also deliver this message to that audience because they're going to deal with some of the downstream effects of this sort of thing, but not necessarily be able to tie it to the root cause.
Which is having somebody who's working on commission, interacting with your frontline staff, describing, one would imagine sometimes, the benefits of the product and the reason you'd want to use it. Is there a sense that you can see why you would be incentivized to focus less on the risks or the downsides of a particular product if you were the rep earning money based on commission? Has that been looked at as well?
So I think a few issues come up. So I had the chance to actually shadow some sales representatives delivering in-services during this study. So one sales representative was doing in-services on an isolation gown. So this is pretty basic thing to use, one would think. He had to ask me going through the hospital which units would actually use an isolation gown because he got yelled at by some nurses in the infusion clinic, a day ward, because he stumbled in there, interrupted them, and they don't use isolation gowns. They don't have rooms. And so you, first of all, I think, have the possibility that misinformation will be delivered. When nurses asked him questions, for example, you know, on grand rounds, do all the people who pile into the room, but all the 10 med students behind the doctor, do they all have to gown up? These are expensive. And the sales rep answered in a way that the nurse was satisfied, and it validated her concern. Not necessarily with an answer that was evidence-based or in line with the hospital policy and procedure or based on infection control principles. In fact, he told her, because her concern was clearly cost and waste, that it was unnecessary. And so I think you also have reports of nurses describing not only benefits of that product, but disparaging competitors' products that are on the unit, or instances of upselling. So you buy a smart pump, and then the sales rep kind of drops to the frontline staff that if your hospital bought this software or this add-on, the pump could do all these things. And then the nurses have the sense that the pump the hospital bought, they've cheaped out on, and it's inadequate, and there's a higher standard of care, and they start to filter that up through their manager and their educator. And so it's also a way to plant a seed to create a sense of often want or anxiety that is really at the heart of a lot of marketing efforts to continue to promote the product. I think the other thing that these interactions do is attempt to increase the volume of use. So once that product's in the hospital, that's great. But the company will make money if they can convince the hospital to up the number of that product that they stock. And so if nurses are comfortable using it, if they like using it, if they can think of other indications for that product's use, then that will help to increase the volume of stock and ultimately the company's profits.
Well, there's a lot of incentives there that you might not think about as a healthcare provider. You just think, oh, this is a, we don't even know the costs as a frontline worker of what the various products are. That's not something that's shared with us. And so our ability to gauge value for the patient versus cost to the system is really just doesn't exist a lot of the time if you're marketing directly to me where I work in my environment anyway. I don't know if that's, so your research was done in the States, right? And do you have a sense of how that compares in terms of the volume of marketing to nurses in the States versus in other countries, particularly Canada?
So there hasn't been any comparative research done. So the only sense I really have is anecdotal from time in Australia, time in Canada, nurses I know and have met. And I think it's important to remember that the companies we're talking about are multinational. And so they have offices and subsidiaries in every country. And at least from pharmaceutical industry research, we have some sense that similar activities, similar volumes are happening in different countries. So, for example, in Australia, pharma companies have to report every event, educational event, that they sponsor for health professionals. And they did so over a four-year period. So we know, for example, that they were hosting about 600 events per week. This is a population just a bit smaller than Canada, which is enough for about every health professional in every discipline to attend at least once, and spending close to $300 million over the 4 years. And I think we found that at least at 40% of those events, at least one nurse was in attendance. So they're quite multidisciplinary. And so I think we have some inklings that similar activities are taking place. What we don't know, I think the United States, for example, purchasing happens much more locally at the level of the hospital, whereas in countries with regional or provincial or state health systems, it might be different. But I'm also suspicious because when I started this work in the States, everyone I encountered said, well, our nurses don't really interact with industry, and why would industry market to nurses anyway? And so I get that question pretty much everywhere I go and whomever I'm speaking to, which makes me think that actually similar things might be going on. And I would love to do more work to find out what's going on here in the Canadian context.
Well, we look forward to hearing that. You certainly would not want to inhibit innovation. You want to get new products that are valuable to patient care to the bedside, and you want to have the nurses and patients who are using those products informing how those can be made and finding innovative solutions for some of the problems that we have at the bedside in terms of documentation, technology, direct care products, medications. So how do you foresee balancing the challenge of reducing overconsumption and, you know, profit-driven motives for promoting use versus really welcoming innovative products into the care environment? How do you see balancing those two needs?
It's certainly a challenge because we all know the demands placed on nurses' time in the context of a shift. And I think health professionals in general have a massive challenge in trying to keep up with updates in their field, new technologies, new innovation. But I question the claim that interactions with industry are the gateway to learning about innovation. So, for example, when I talk to the wound care nurse specialist who has a drawer full of samples, and if she's presented with a difficult case or a patient with a really difficult wound, she'll rifle through that, pull something out, try it, might work, might not. And then the patient gets transferred and suddenly doesn't have access to that, or we can't follow the outcomes, or what's in her drawer it may not even represent the full range of options. And I think time and time again, what happens is things like samples or brochures or information is introduced, but that is not clinician-driven. That is not nurses saying, here are the problems we have. These are the problems we need to solve. And what we see when you step back and look at the big picture is that industry is delivering innovation only in places where it's going to reap a return. So we don't see a lot of innovative samples delivered into the med-surg units, for example, or in pediatrics. It's a very small market, so it's not a place there's a lot of incentives. And so in areas like the cardiac cath lab or the OR, where we know they've got big budgets and a high rate of new technology adoption, we might see those things coming in, but again, as a profession or a health system, is that truly addressing our needs? And I think there are models of institutions that have tackled this in really interesting ways. So Kaiser Permanente in the States, they actually have a lab where nurses are pulled off the floor, paid for their time, and get to interact with a range of products without a sales rep present, so they can independently form a judgment about new things, become aware of them. But they also come to that lab with their own clinical problems and priorities as an institution, rather than reacting to the onslaught of samples or branded water bottles or the slew of new product requests that come after conference season, for example.
That sounds amazing. Is there a free lunch?
I hope so. I hope so.
We have to compete here.
It's true. And I think it's really a challenge. You know, my colleagues and I were often accused of wanting to take away free lunch. And we know that nurses work very hard. And often the free lunch you get is even just pizza or Chinese food. It's not even the fancy free lunch. But I think there's a real cost to that free lunch that we need to acknowledge as a profession.
Yeah, cost to the sustainability of our healthcare system in terms of, I was looking at some of the data around the size of the Canadian market and the per capita expenditure on health-related products, and it's significant. If you look at other nations in the world, we're pretty high. I think we were like number 6 per capita spending on health-related products. That's, I don't know, maybe there are ways that we could really make sure that the products we're using are actually meeting patient and provider needs rather than being influenced in other ways. It seems like a really important place to look and really novel. There's not a lot of other people. I've not even come across this idea. Suddenly I'm looking in my supply room. I'm like, how'd this get here? Thinking about all of these products that we use every day in a totally other light. And I think that your book is, first of all, really interesting to read, and I would definitely highly recommend it to bedside nurses, administrators, anybody who's managing nursing and thinking about running an institution. Really important insights into something we really need to take a better look at as a group of professionals in charge of looking after the interests of patients and future patients and families as well.
Well, thank you for that. And I really do hope it can reach those audiences. My sister is a NICU nurse, and she read drafts of this manuscript on her night shift with instructions to circle the boring bits. And so I really aim for it to speak to practicing nurses and people who are on the front lines dealing with this.
Because I think we're talking here very briefly about a couple of the topics, but you go very in-depth. So in no way does this conversation replace reading the book. As well, I love the way you bring stories forward. You use a lot of actual clinical stories that are relatable and really interesting, and you bring them to light from a variety of different care environments. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What are you doing now in terms of your research? What are you looking at these days?
So as we discussed, I am back in Canada after about 10 years overseas doing my PhD and postdoctoral work, and I'm new to Toronto. So I just landed in January and survived the first winter, which I kind of blacked out the fact that it'll come again.
You're from Edmonton, Quinn.
It's been a long time. It's been a long time. It's a repressed memory of winter. So I'm looking to form some relationships and find other people who are interested in unpacking some of this in the Canadian context. This summer, my research assistants, who are amazing undergraduate nursing students here, we teamed up with my colleague, Dr. Craig Dale, who is a former critical care nurse and specializes in oral health in acute care settings. And we really want to start unpicking this idea of industry as an educator. So we looked at oral health, which is a domain very much within nursing's scope and control and leadership, and looked at the four major companies manufacturing oral health products for acute care settings, and found that all of their websites contained large sections for clinical education or training or support. So we downloaded all these documents. I think we have close to 80 documents that range from training videos to brochures to little lanyard assessment cards.
Oh, the lanyard card.
Protocol templates. So you just put in your hospital's name and they've got your oral health protocol all laid out. Very helpful, right? And my students went through and dug through and pulled out all the claims that they made about products or processes. And we reasoned that if they were educational materials, hopefully they're scientific and evidence-based. So they then pulled out all the references and made an assessment about whether the reference supported the claim. So first of all, they found that I think close to 40% of the claims had no reference. And then they're finding that over half the references don't actually support the claim. So either it was a bit of a random reference and we couldn't see the connection, or the findings were not statistically significant but were represented as such in the claim, or it was done in a completely different population, like long-term care or even the community, but presented for a critical care audience. And so we're starting to question whether these materials are truly educational. And Health Canada has recently come out with some guidance trying to make the distinction between promotional and non-promotional materials from companies. So right now, these would fall under non-promotional, but we're starting to see some very consistent messaging that's not necessarily evidence-based under the guise of educational materials.
That is concerning because there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that promotional materials that I come into contact with. It's posted around my unit, and which nurse individually has the time to go through and, as you're doing, unpack all of that? But it does suggest that skepticism is probably necessary.
Yes.
Yikes. My last question for you is, why has nobody offered to take me out for dinner? Come on, you rep companies. Where's my invitation?
And I think this is a common sentiment. And I have colleagues who have done surveys with nurses. And I think the title of her paper, she's a nurse in New Zealand, a nurse researcher. And her paper is titled, "But Doctors Do It." And I think this is a really challenging dynamic we have to take on in healthcare, is that for many nurses, marketing is validating. And it feels like long overdue recognition of their practice and skills and knowledge. And industry, in some ways, has purposefully set up this dynamic. They play specialists and the GPs off each other in much the same way. And now we see nurses and pharmacists and other health professionals also kind of in this game where being marketed to somehow feels prestigious. And I think this is where we really need to push back as a profession and have these conversations out in the open and engage in what people have called industry denormalization, to point to the ways that you are actually not being recognized or validated, but perhaps exploited, and that they're capitalizing on the credibility or trust that nurses have.
I think that is a beautiful last word to end on, Quinn.
Thank you.
Well said. Thank you so much for the work that you do. Could you just keep going and let us know what we should trust and what we should not? And thank you so much for meeting with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Quinn Grundy with Infiltrating Healthcare. It is a great read. I highly recommend it, and I'm not alone. It was rated one of the top books of 2019 by the American Journal of Nursing. Yay, Quinn, well deserved. This season is supported by funding from Sinai Health System and the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario Advanced Clinical Fellowship Program. And I should probably add that they have no influence over what I say here. Thank you for listening, and big appreciation to the nurses of the 14th level, MedSurg, neglected by industry. And please don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen. Rate, review, share, follow At The Bedside Podcast on Instagram or Twitter. I mean, come on, what's one more box to click at the end of a long day?